If you want to wrap up or bring conversations to a close, we were told to keep things on time, so I think we'll try to start on time, recognizing the fact that we're up against the ice cream line. So, death by chocolate or whatever. But appreciate those of you who are here. Either like me trying to stay away from that ice cream line, or you got your ice cream this afternoon. So, either way, thank you. So, the first session we talked about sort of the lead up and the historical and ecological context for the Wolverine fire, and then we talked about the Wolverine fire itself. And so today we want to kind of talk about the immediate after, or sort of the first couple of years after, and what we kind of can look forward to looking into the future. And before I go too far, I guess I should say my name is Dave Peterson. I'm a research scientist with the U.S. Forest Service, stationed in Wenatchee, Washington. And I've spent about the last 15 years of my career working on post-fire ecology and management, or forest ecology and management, along with a little bit of forest restoration research. And before that, I did prescribed fire in oak savannas in the Midwest. So, been working with fire for about 20 years now, and so this is kind of a been playing with fire. Yes, the story. You know, I do have to admit that when I was in the summer between sixth and seventh grade, I got to go to this science camp with a bunch of older kids who were mostly in junior high and high school. I was the young one of the bunch, and I was the one that always wanted to light the Bunsen burner. They started calling me Pyro, you know, and it might have been, they may have had been more insightful than we knew at the time. I really don't like too many of these, but I do like going and watching. So today I want to basically start out talking about sort of plant strategies or adaptations. I have to be kind of careful about the cause and effect kind of language that we use with this, but how do plants cope with fire, whether it's intentional or accidental, but how does it work? How does it work out for plants when they're dealing with fire? And then I want to give some examples from the last 15 years of looking at post-fire recovery from fires around the Lake Chelan area. Primarily, I'm going to focus on the Deer Point fire that's from 2002 because it's the oldest one that I've studied, and so I have a little bit longer record with that. And if the slide works, we'll look at an equivalent one from the fire from 1994 in the Leavenworth area. I have some John Marshall pictures from there, but for whatever reason, I can't get them to work in PowerPoint very well. they look great on the screen on their computer when you pull them up. And then if we have time, I want to talk about sort of shift focus from live vegetation to dead trees, and maybe spend a few minutes just talking about sort of how dead trees, the whole dynamics of snag dynamics and what happens with dead trees and how it kind of goes through this decomposition stage down to becoming logs and fuel and all that. And then we could hope, as I'm hoping, we'll be as good as in previous sessions where we have lots of time for good questions. So there are any good scientist, you want to try to bin everything up into a few categories, right? And so fire ecologists for the last 50 years have been trying to come up with sort of shorthand ways of describing, hundreds of thousands of plants, and how do you cram them into a few categories that allow you to talk about stuff. And it turns out it's actually a pretty useful approach. So I want to talk about a category that, or a method that was proposed by a guy named Rowe back in 1983 that I think has stood the test of time and is pretty useful, but there are others. So one class of plants that Rowe talked about was, he said basically you could look at two different characteristics, sort of can they persist through fire and how do they regenerate after fire, sort of this whole thing. So the first category is endurers, and these are kind of suited to really frequent fire situations. And there are species that resprout after fire from buds that are protected, usually like on the root collars or on below ground root organs. So, and it's kind of a broad category. I mean, you could have suckering in aspen would count. Oaks that resprout from the root collar in the Midwest, very, very good example that John Muir talked about, that they could just resprout every year from those root collars for hundreds of years. It turns out that in the Northwest, and particularly in the interior Northwest, an awful lot of our shrubs can do that. And especially if it's not a really super hot fire. I mean, theoretically, you could have a fire that burns for a really long time and cooks those roots out and actually kills them. But the point is that soil's a pretty good insulator. And as long as the residence time for your fire isn't too long, the soil will actually insulate below ground plant parts pretty effectively. And so many plants can come right back after a fire and develop. And the advantage there is you already have a pre-made root system. Just like in the orchards in Wenatchee, often, you know, if they're going to redo it, they just chop it off and stick grafts onto the existing root system, right? Because you get a tree a lot. You don't have to grow that whole root system again. Same kind of thing with resprouting. So we call those endurers because they can basically just keep enduring fire and persist. But the individual persists, and then therefore the population also persists. Let's see. So just a couple of examples. Again, many of the shrubs around here do. But a couple I found on the 10-mile trail this morning. This blue elderberry, Sambucus, is a pretty common sprouter. And over there, a little less common, but interesting, the spreading dogbane. And again, we could, you know, the Douglas maple will generally sprout if it's not too hot. Many. So another category where the actual individual, did I get the wrong species? Okay, good. These guys have been doing all this stuff all summer. I'm a little worried there. I tried my. So another category is the resistors. And this is, again, where a strategy where the point is to try to have the individual survive the fire. And ponderosa pine is kind of the classic example around here of a resistor. If you've ever looked at a fairly mature ponderosa pine, they put a lot of energy into bark. And so they'll have very thick bark. It's corky bark, so it's kind of like, it's got very good insulating properties. And it just kind of, it does kind of flake off over years, but you still maintain a really good insulating layer around there. And so, again, any kind of a fire that doesn't have a super long residence time is going to come through there. They're not very shade tolerant, so they tend to self-prune up to a pretty good level. And so they're just made to take it. I've actually seen, I have fire scars. Ponderosa pines are also good for collecting fire scars. And we've got a whole warehouse full of them at the lab from a previous scientist who collected. And you know, you see places where the first fire scar is on a tree this big around. So, just a sapling that managed to get a low severity fire through was enough to damage the bark, but not enough to actually kill the tree. And we've done it. I've done stuff with, you know, trees that were 3-4 inches in diameter and maybe 15 feet tall, where the districts have sent a pretty hot fire down through there, and you come out of it, all the needles are scorched. And you think, oh gosh, what did we do? And the next spring, it's all green, and you know, all you lost were a few little trees. So they're very hardy tree. The other thing they do, besides having thick bark, is if you ever look at a ponderosa pine, there's a few around here. They have very thick branches. You don't have the really skinny little branch tips that you have with, say, Douglas fir or some of the other trees around here. They have very thick. Even the smallest branches are pretty thick, going all the way out to the bud. That, again, just lets them endure heat for a longer period than their neighbors. You can still kill them, but it takes a lot longer. And so, again, on the left there is a good example of a wildfire going through a ponderosa pine stand. In many cases, there was a whole lot of scorch, but they came back. The other thing to note about is that many of the trees in this valley and in this part of the become resistors once they get to be a certain size. So Douglas fir, once you get about, you know, it's kind of a combination of age and size, but once they get to be fairly good size, maybe 80 to 100 years, they develop that same kind of thick bark. Even the grand fir, which is not normally considered a very tolerant of fire, if you get a big enough one, it's got pretty thick bark too. Hmm. In fact, a few weeks ago, we were trying to tease apart what were these things, because they looked an awful lot like Douglas fir and everything else, with that thick bark. So a third class is we call the invaders. These have no, they may or may not be able to sprout or whatever, but basically their big strength is producing copious amounts of seed that fly everywhere. It's kind of the shotgun, you know, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks kind of thing. They just produce thousands and thousands of seeds. They're often kind of cottony or very winged. They'll float, fly around in the wind. And they're, you know, one author talked about that while the resistors, basically while fire seeks out resistors because they often make things more flammable, these kind of things seek out fire. They basically they're putting out a whole lot of seed looking for the kinds of bare soil conditions that fires produce. Now, they're probably going to do pretty well also on avalanche slopes, and I mean there are other kinds of disturbances that create that, but think about it, it has to be a pretty tiny seed in order to fly very far. And so they don't have a lot of stored energy. They've got to be able to get down on that mineral soil, so when they put down their little root, it has to get in there and not be susceptible to drying out later in the year. So it's kind of one of those things. They've got to find the little nooks and crannies where they can become established. But the good news is that they can reproduce after about a year. So, you know, and if anybody's looked at, so this picture here is schooler willow, which we don't have as much of in this valley as I kind of was expecting, but there has been a lot of schooler willow historically between here and say the trail junction. I think there was a lot of schooler willow when we had a lot bigger avalanches coming down, and about 10, 15 years ago, a lot of it died out. But you'll still see it around the valley, and it's all over the Lake Chelan area in general, especially at sort of mid to higher elevations. It's a woody shrub, but it can produce seed after about a year in some cases, which is amazing to me. The more classic one is fireweed, which we have in great abundance in the valley. So that pinkish purple flower that you've seen riding the bus up and down the valley, that's fireweed. These long stalks of flowers all turn into those kinds of seeds, and will release those seeds to fly wherever they can. So they're going to take over for the next couple of years, 3 years, 4 years. But they're not real shade tolerant, so eventually that population will kind of dwindle and be replaced as other things get bigger. But in the meantime, they're very useful for colonizing sites, putting some organic matter on the soil, making the site a little more civil for other things to come along. I was also going to mention yarrow. This Achillea millefolium, yarrow is one that actually I used 15 years ago as a part of an experiment, because that was one of, at the time it was sort of a radical thing that people were throwing into a perennial weed mix to compete with exotic species after fire. On the Deer Point, they mixed it in with a bunch of perennial grasses. I'm not even sure why, but they had done it. We did some experiments with it. It turned out it was the only species of that mix that really had any effect in the first couple of years. But it turned out a couple other people also found that it had a lot of effect, and it got to the point where they now cultivate yarrow specifically for these seed mixes, either for sometimes for post-fire, you know, broadcasting, but often for like roadside mixes and stuff where they have to, you know, you need to try to reduce erosion. And so there's actually farms around where people are growing it. But again, it's a lot like the fireweed. It doesn't have, I don't think it has much of a winged seed necessarily, but they're really, really tiny, and they're gonna blow. It probably has a little wing to it, I'm not sure, but very tiny. I mean, if you don't want to try to count these things because it's kind of like a microscope. But they do produce, and they're a very good fire follower, but they also follow other disturbance. So a fourth category, again, the invaders are cedars. Another kind of cedar is what we call the evaders. And these are ones, plants that, they basically store seed in some sort of a seed bank. In the case of lodgepole pine there in the top, basically they produce cones that stay attached to the branch of the tree for a really long time. And in some percentage of those cones are what we call serotonous, and there are more and less serotonous lodgepole pines, but basically the serotonous ones stay sealed. They have kind of a resin that keeps that cone sealed up tight, and it holds onto that seed and keeps it fresh. And then, but these the lodgepole pines are also kind of built to burn. They tend to hold on to all their lower branches. They create very flammable needles and stuff. And so when fire comes along, the tree itself tends to go up pretty spectacularly. But in the process, it basically burns those cones enough to dry, to break that seal. And as they dry out afterward, the seeds can come down onto this bare mineral soil that is really good for their establishment. Yellowstone is a classic example of a lodgepole pine system where this has happened. Where we know, and many of us know, in that in '88 there was a big fire in Yellowstone, and that was in many areas went through lodgepole pine stands that then dropped those seeds down. If you go back there now, you have what, almost 25 to 30 year old lodgepole pine stands there, because that's kind of a renewal. So. In that case, even though the individuals die, the population stays on the site because they store that seed bank and they're able to hang on to that site for a longer period of time. And it's been kind of noted this is a really good strategy, although lodgepole pines can live for 100 to 150 years, it's a good strategy for short-lived species if your individual doesn't tend to live as long as the fire return interval. And so if you're going to die, if you know you're only going to live about 30 years and the mean fire return interval is 50 years, and you're not very good at competing with your neighbors, one way that can work out is if the plant can save its seed in a seed bank, then it's technically still there, it's just not growing and stuff, and it can wait for the next disturbance to come along. So that's one that does this. There's some other examples, and I can't document this one, so I'm on a little bit, but I'm pretty convinced that lupins must do that as well, because on this fire, there were some really hot areas. The other place you could store seed is in the soil seed bank, and there are a number of species, and I'm pretty sure lupin does it, but the one that I know does it is this snowbrush, Ceanothus volutinus. It's very common around here. It used to be very common up toward the miners' village. It kind of gets kind of shaded out over time. But you'll probably see a lot of very shiny green shrub with fairly odorous white blossoms. Some people like the smell, some people really don't like it. Some of my field crew have really not liked it. But it's one of those species that basically is only going to live for about 30 or 40 years, and they tend to senesce after a while and just kind of run out of steam. But every year they're depositing these seeds in the soil bank, or virtually every year, and so that seed accumulates. And then the way the story goes is that when fires come along, you might have an organic matter and sort of upper soil layer that's got all these seeds in it. And depending on how hot the fire is, it's going to burn off some of that layer. But at some depth, it's just the right temperature to crack the seed coat and allow water to get in so that after the fire has gone away and the rains come, the water sinks into that seed, allows things to expand, and it can germinate. And somebody's shown they can live for at least 50 years in the soil bank. And some have speculated maybe 100, but I think they've shown, with known past fires and known populations, at least 50 years. And it looks like looks to me like the lupins can do it too. I know some of the legumes can do that. I've seen hog peanut in the Midwest that seems to do that. Anyway, we'll move on. The last is sort of the everybody else. Got to have an everybody else category, right? But these are the avoiders. Typically, these are the kinds of things you would find in places that don't burn very often. They've never evolved any particularly great mechanisms for dealing directly with fire. And so you know, they're basically, some of them are like, look at fire die, and others, you know, maybe moderately able to, well, things like Grand Fur, you know, maybe if it's really old, it can survive, but it's got to be pretty old in order to do it. And so they're pretty fire sensitive in general, but they usually have some other stuff going for them in that they're often, like in the west side, many of the west side species are very shade tone, like a hemlock. Hemlock's not great with fire unless it's a real old tree, but it's very shade tolerant, and it can hang out in wet areas. Western red cedar is probably another real good example. Again, okay when it's really big, but they tend to hang out in wet areas, little refuges, and they're able to then, after the fire, they have a seed source that persists, and they can kind of start invading the surrounding areas. Sometimes they can go right away. Sometimes they need to wait for some other plants to get established and then come in under them because they need the shade or something. So those are the avoiders.
One thing about Bracken and Mile Trail, the bracken fern are quite flourishing.
Yes.
I was surprised. I thought they didn't wiped out.
Well, they can sprout. I'm not sure. Travis, do you know, are they rhizominous or do they? Lucy, your chance? Well, typically they do have spores, but I don't think that's how they're reproducing.
Yeah,
I think
sure
these are coming back from right, from root.
Are you talking about like along the 10-mile trail? Because a lot of times, along those paths, it sort of acts as a fire break, and so I'm assuming that that's a bit of a lower intensity. So if they're rhizominous, then they can survive and then prop up. I've noticed that along a lot of trails in the valley.
Yeah, bracken's another one of those. It's probably, and actually one author kind of calls them super species that can be shade tolerant and also resprout after fire, you know, because that's like the best of both worlds, right? You can come back after fire, but you can also persist for a long time in the closed forest. This system was not designed to work for animals, but because people are always interested in how the, you know, there are, and I've had a couple questions this week about how animals deal with fire, I thought I'd throw this one slide in. So you can kind of say that, you know, small mammals, little critters, have holes in the ground, and in many respects they can kind of persist like a resistor and use that soil as an insulation. So if a fire is coming by fairly rapidly, again, residence time is pretty important, but you know, if the fire fronts through within a few minutes, they might be able to survive in their little hole and, you know, not having a very good time of it, but they're down there and then they can come back up and start looking for food and we had an offside I think maybe during the session about the St. Helens, there was a question about Mount St. Helens where, you know, again, they survived Mount St. Helens by being below ground and then were able to come back up. So small mammals have a little bit of that going for them. Of course, if you're a bigger animal, you can try running away or flying away. And that's, you know, so the, and then, but there are inevitably some that get trapped and are simply killed. The bigger issue may very well be just what we do in terms of habitat modification and altering food webs, because, you know, they're going to come, even once the fire goes through, kind of the whole world has changed at that point, and it may be for the better or for the worse, but at some point they've got to start foraging for food then and or migrating to some other place where they can find food. So the last session, at the end of the last session, we talked a little bit about, oh my gosh.
Here it goes.
Can I ask about the deer a little bit before we move on?
Yeah, that'd be a great thing to do. Why don't you do that?
Available to escape the fire on a pretty strong measure, or what portion of them lose out?
I think they can get out of the way pretty. I mean, they've got good noses. I mean, you know, I'm sure every fire you find some bones and stuff, but you don't ever know for sure how many of those were there beforehand and not. But they're very mobile. I mean, they can run faster than you can, and they're pretty skitterish. So I mean, the thing is to get a head start, and well, there's one strategy right there. That's deer, you know. Might not work, but.
What about some? I know this is an offshoot, but what about the animals smelling the smoke that's coming over? No fire danger here.
Right.
What's their response to this, do you think?
No, I think they smell smoke and say, I maybe should be somewhere else. I mean, especially the larger ones. You know, the small ones, I mean, any critter kind of knows what its range is, right? I mean, you live it every, even if they're not the brightest bulb in the bunch, I mean, they kind of know where they go. And so, you know, I think enough of them seem to know that either when there's danger, and that's what fire really is for them, you either head below ground or you head to water or you fly away or whatever you're able to do when danger comes. And I think there's enough instinct and stuff that when they smell smoke, an awful lot of them think danger and have some sort of response. Now, in some cases, it may be a bad response, but you don't get the sense that, I mean, even snakes. I mean, here's a great firefighter story, you know, and it's not mine, but I've heard it from enough firefighters to start believing it, that, you know, they have to watch when they're digging line and stuff because the snakes will be, rattlesnakes and stuff will be fleeing the fire. And so the guys that are digging trench have to watch out for, you know, snakes. And this is not the joke. I did get my sister-in-law on a snake migratory joke once, and it's not migrate, but I mean they do. Even the snakes want to get to a safe place, wherever that is. Okay, this may fast forward or not. Yes, yeah. It's going to. But anyway, so we showed this map. I think it'll stop now. And this is Railroad Creek Valley after the fire. You can see we had a lot of the high severity, moderate severity, some low severity. That's really all I was trying to show with that. And with that comes some hazards, and I'm going to see if I can do this. There we go. Stay. You know, the hazards associated with that are all this exposed dry soil that has the potential to either repel water and cause flooding problems, or in the process of water running off, pick stuff up and cause debris flow problems. And really, the ultimate cure for that is vegetation recovery. That's kind of burying the lead, but that's kind of the lead in for this. So I want to show you some stuff from the Deer Point fire. This is Mitchell Creek. This is kind of one of the drier sites on the on Deer Point fire. It'd be kind of across the lake from Fields Point parking lot, and then up a ways. But if you kind of roughly across the lake from Fields Point and go up to about 3,500 feet, maybe 3,000, 3,500 feet, there's a road that goes all along that side of the lake. Pretty cool road. It goes in and out of all the canyons. And this was one of the areas burned in the Deer Point fire. It had actually previously burned in 1970 and burned again in 2002. So after 1970, there had been a lot of work at trying to get trees established on the site. And you can see that after 30 years, they weren't really, they were living, but they weren't really doing that great. But this photo is actually the first, so this is 1 year after the fire. I don't have the best photos of the actual fire, but all these were picked to be high severity sites. So basically, when we went in right after the fire, all you saw was basically charred wood and bare soil. So the fire did a very good job of taking off the tops of everything, or burning the tops. So you can see after 1 year, this site has got a lot going on. Lots and lots of grasses, lots of forbs and flowering plants, and a few sprouting shrubs. So this is kind of which category of adapters is this?
Resistor.
Huh?
Resistor?
Some resistors, but mostly endurers. Mm-hmm. These are the ones that are basically, they're the above ground stuff is getting burned up, but basically the vital organs are being protected down below ground, and so they're coming right back. They're hanging on to what resources they have. If we flip forward a little bit, 8 years later, what's different?
Trees
are gone.
Not a whole lot. Yeah, those dead trees have fallen over in the 8 year period. But if you look at the ground, there's a little less bare soil. I mean, those shrubs got a little bit bigger, the grass has spread out a little bit, but you know, it really looks very similar. It's just a little bit more of the same. And really by year three, this one hasn't changed a whole lot. I mean, we were just back there this spring resurveying it again at year 15. And in year 15, we finally have some seedlings that are about that tall. Not a lot, but a few. Here's a couple of years ago in 2015, what it looked like, some different views.
The seedlings came back of their own, or were they planted?
That's not real clear. I'm pretty sure they've gotten planted, but there's potential for some. But these there were probably too many. It's a long way to a seed source, and so I'm pretty sure they were planted. But they would have been planted about five. I mean, I'm pretty sure what happened is that the district came through after 5 years and did a seedling survey and said, well, there's not enough here, we should do something. So they planted a few, and most of them died, but some of them. So, you know, 15 years, so you've got 10 years. Some of them have survived 8 to 10 years, and that's what we're seeing and that are getting close to knee-high. But, they're, you know, it's a rough life. So this is Grade Creek, which is probably a lot more comparable to Railroad Creek Valley, particularly the lower parts of the valley. Before the fire, it was a fairly dense, although not overly dense, mixture of lodgepole pine with Douglas fir and a little bit of ponderosa pine. So think of it as sort of the south side of the valley here, the north facing, you know, the base of the north facing slope down there, maybe around Dom Key, or what would have been there. Maybe a little higher up in the valley. It fried. I mean, there was ash 2 inches deep when I went in there the first time. Very, very, very little left. However, after the first year, not nearly as abundant as the previous one. This is this Spirea betulifolia, or birch leaf Spirea, I guess. A small shrub, but that seemed to do really well in the fire. You can see over here a bigger sprouting shrub that it was either Ocean Spray or was I think it was Ocean Spray. It might have been the elderberry, but there were some random big shrubs that managed to survive. What was interesting about this, though, and I couldn't find my year three picture, which I'm sort of annoyed about, but What we started seeing in year two, particularly the end of year one and year two, is these itty bitty little ceanothus coming up. And they were the first year they were just like this with these tiny, tiny little leaves. And by year three, they were about this tall. And I'll go here. By the time I came back in year nine, they were up to here. In fact, the lodgepole pines that came down out of the sea bank, out of the canopy, and established, and the ceanothus were kind of having this race to see which one could overtop the other one. And so this was in 2011. Again, they were just about even, and I was thinking, yeah, I went in there and almost got lost. But when we came back in 2015, the pines had won. And in looking at it and looking at what happened, it seemed a combination of, for one thing, the ceanothus kind of tend to die back each year, so the lodgepole pine had a winter-spring period where they could potentially kind of had no competition in a lot of soil water. The other thing is that I actually talked to one of the district people who talked about that snowpack was one I hadn't thought about, but because the ceanothus hang on to a lot of their leaves, they collect snowpack, and so every year after it was 6 feet tall, I went back the following spring. I didn't take pictures of it, but that same stuff was down here because it got munched, and apparently apparently somewhere in that next 2-3 years it got munched to the point where it didn't actually rebound. Technical term. This was a higher elevation site we had. This was kind of up near the upper limit of Douglas fir. Again, a lot of lodgepole pine. It had burned in 1970, so there was very, very dense, very, very dense lodgepole pine. But you could tell it had at one point been very large Douglas firs, because there were a lot of very large logs that had been laying on the ground. Many of which burned up in this, but there were enough laying left over that we could kind of tell that back in the 1920s or something, it had been a pretty good-sized Douglas fir stand. Anyway, it burned pretty thoroughly. The first year, it was so severe that we really only had four species there were a couple other we found one of, but out of all our plots, we only really found it was basically the same four species occurring over and over, and not very densely. By year three, These are our two, this is our invader. This is that schooler willow that's taking off. And it's already producing seed and having multiple generations going. These are those lupins. This is kind of the right next to our plots, but basically this was a bunch of lupin that had come out of the seed bank. And so that's, the lupin's particularly interesting because it's a nitrogen fixer. And so is the ceanothus. So those are kind of cool ones to have in your mix because they're gonna actually fertilize the soil a little bit. Right around the corner from lupin is one of the things that made the biggest impression on me is this Poison Creek. It had been part of that same 1970 fire. It had a lot more lodgepole. And so after that 1970 fire, all that lodgepole fell down on the ground and must have been a fuel bed a foot or two deep. And so when this fire came through, these little black marks were all the little lodgepole pine, the little 20 to 30 year old lodgepole pines that were coming up. But you can see the remnant logs there. There were so many, and it burned for hours and hours and hours. And what was left was really just a moonscape. And there were all these little dust devils going around everywhere. And so that's about the most severe fire I've seen. I mean, I thought maybe when I saw Domke that we had the same thing going on, where it reburned the Domke fire. But fortunately, that's proved not to be as bad. But this pretty much cooked everything. And so by year three, there's a little bit going on here, but mostly that's that schooler willow that's managing to fly long distances. Turned out there was a whole hillside of lupin that came out of the soil seed bank that was very pretty in June. But again, very, very slow. And it's still, if we go to year 13, you can see it's still kind of basically a shrubland. And even the district did go through with a pretty thorough planting project for lodgepole pine, but there's still, even the planted ones are really only about, you know, maybe as tall as me at the most. Oh, okay, can you see that? Yeah, that's not bad. So this is John Marshall's work from, this was the Tyee fire near Leavenworth, and 1994 was a very big fire year in north central Washington, one of the first big ones, really big ones that we had, because about 150,000 acres burned that year. And John, through a contract with the Okanagan Wenatchee, started photographing these. He's a much better photographer than I am, created some fixed photo points. And he was willing to share one set with me that worked. So you can see here, this is right after the fire where he set this, and notice that this fairly large tree here with a little notch in it. So that's year zero. 2 years later, obviously somebody came in and cut down that. They did a little bit of a harvest. And you can see, and some of this may have been actually seeded wheat, because in those days they were into seeding wheat for soil erosion control. But you can see a lot of grasses, not much else. Here's year nine. Lots of shrubs. You can still see these grasses poking through, but the shrubs are starting to come up and over. And near year 20, so this was not very long ago, he went back, and you can see at this point it's all shrubs. These trees are starting to make an appearance, and it's really starting to turn back into sort of a combination of shrub and forest again. But that's 20 years. So anyway, just to kind of summarize, I mean, I didn't try to go too crazy with, you know, telling which are resistors and endurers and everything, but you can kind of see where this idea that right after the fire, these endurers are coming back, and these invaders are being pretty important, and of course the resistors, because they managed to hang on. So you got those three groups that tend to start things out, and then these evaders are coming out of the seed bank, so they're there, but they have to develop all new root systems and stuff, so it takes them a little while longer to assert themselves and to be able to. But they can eventually become very important, and then eventually we have, you know, the taller things, like the taller shrubs, and so you start out with this real low vegetation, and it sort of, you know, size eventually wins generally, but as the taller things get taller, you have this change. And the one thing that's important to think is that these back in the early 20th century, there was a lot of effort to try to come up with, you know, mechanistic plant succession patterns, and, you know, that this paves the way for this, which paves the way for this, which paves the way for this. And then there have been, ecologists have argued whether is it sequential, or is it you throw everything into the mix initially and it sorts itself out and you come out with something. They're still arguing over it, so there's no necessarily right answer. You can have whatever one you want. But I think the idea is there's no single answer. Like any community, there's a lot of chance involved. It depends on what you get after a fire, depends on what you had before the fire, depends on, you know, how bad the fire was. It depends on what's the weather like for the first couple of years after a fire. It depends on some vagaries of what seed sources are still somewhere nearby on the landscape and can get there. And so what the argument is made, and I think I very much would like to say, is that rather than worrying a lot about species, which are all very different and they're very interesting, you know, that's why these trait type classification systems are useful. And this may not be the best one. Ecologists nowadays, plant ecologists are finally falling in love with plant traits, and they're coming up with lots of really cool ways of saying how this trait exerts itself and then this one, and that's how communities assemble themselves. But this idea that, you know, establishment is something of a random process, and whatever there is a bit of a winner-take-all sort of thing, that whatever can get there first is going to tend to persist for at least a fairly long time. So that's why endurers have a good strategy, because they're like, and the resistors, they're like, hey, we're going to hang on to what we've got, or at least a lot of what we have. The invaders have an advantage because they can get there before, and they tend to have really fast growth rates. The endurers are a little, you know, a little setback, but, you know, if they can mix in some nitrogen fixation and actually fertilize themselves, maybe that helps them catch up a little bit. And eventually, the avoiders often, you know, if you keep disturbance away long enough, the avoiders will probably eventually win and become much more increasingly dominant. But it's going to take a long time, and if fire or some other disturbance comes back in the meantime, then you know they're going to stay on the sidelines. So.
Sorry.
Oh, shoot.
So just a few. Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good. These are the ones I copied from the last slideshow. Okay. So anyway, we talked about the dead trees, which I think is worth focusing on for a minute or two. Most trees we found are gonna break off, you know, 10 to 20 feet up, or they're gonna fall over entirely in the first 10 to 20 years after fire. Actually, 10 to 15, and I've got a little bit of a graph here in a minute. And that causes safety concerns along trails, you know, road access issues. So we're gonna have to keep worrying about that. And eventually, it becomes fuel for the next fire. This is a nice little diagram that, for those of you who are really into snag dynamics, so this is sort of the decay. So here's your live tree, sort of live tree, dead tree. First, what we do is we lose a lot of these fine branches, and the bark starts to slough off, and these things get deposited down below. Eventually, we've lost most all the branches. Here's where we talk about the tops breaking off. Oftentimes, there's a zone of humidity up a certain distance where the decomposition processes seem to be the most effective. And so, you know, if a tree is really tall, it's catching a lot of wind, right? So it's sort of torquing, and if there's a weak spot, it's going to tend to break off. Once it breaks off, then it's not nearly as tall, doesn't catch nearly as much wind, and generally the strongest part is the part that's left. So that's when it can persist for quite a while. So you can see these things are sort of slowly getting shorter and shorter, and eventually it's either a stump or the whole thing kind of crashes. And same thing happens with logs. So if it does happen to fall over for whatever reason, you have the same thing. Log tends to be perched on its branches, then comes in contact with the soil. Once that happens, the moisture level changes a little bit, and decomposition speeds up, so it starts kind of getting looser and looser, and eventually gets incorporated in the soil.
Are there certain snags in this area that persist longer? I mean, you see them up on the ridges that are really old.
Yes.
What kind of trees are you going to talk about them?
Let me talk about that in just a sec.
Thanks.
So there's an example on the Right, it was that 1994 fire that we went back to about 25 years later. You see kind of a mixture of stuff standing or down, but it's almost all, you know, you're not going to see much of anything standing whole. And this decomposition process, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I'm happy to talk to you about offline about it. It's really kind of a cool process where the dead tree, you know, when, as soon as it dies, the wood borers come in, invade the tree. They introduce fungi that start eating away at the better parts of the wood, and they deposit their eggs. And then when the larvae come out, they start eating the fungal hyphae. They're sort of basically farming fungi inside of a tree for their young, which then use that to develop energy to pupate and become another mature adult and emerge and go attack another tree. And they can do that until basically the tree dries out. So it's a fairly short window. But meanwhile, there's a bunch of these little creepy crawly wormy guys in there, right? And so that's what the woodpeckers you know, and you can hear them, but so the woodpeckers go, hey, food. So they're coming around. That's why woodpeckers are pecking into all these trees, even if they're not actually trying to create a nest. They're pecking holes trying to get at these larvae, which they can then peck out and bring home to Junior and have their family grow faster. And then they do make some cavities, which then can be used by other species that aren't as good at making the holes, but like to use the used holes that the woodpeckers leave behind. And some of that, the combination of the structural, you know, being pecked at, plus having all these fungal infections, is part of what eventually creates this mechanical force that allows the trees to fall over. At which point, then the ants get in there, and then different kinds of woodpeckers come and take the ants out. And so you have this, what I like to think of as a resource pulse, that these dead trees really do create this pulse of a new resource. And a new food web that sort of changes the existing conditions. And then the real question is just, you know, how many trees, how big can the pulse be before it sort of is so much that nothing can use it? But there's a really cool sequence of events that comes out. And you'll see, I put this little picture Marcia took this morning, these little fungal bodies coming out of the mm-hmm. out of the tree. You'll see a lot of that on Ten Mile Creek or around here on these dead trees. And that's just evidence that there have been these wood borers, or sometimes bark beetles if it's alive, but they've managed to get in there and infect the tree with these fungi. And so a lot of them are these little white ones like this, but there's other colors and stuff, and those are just different fungi that have managed to get in there. So back to your this is the only data I'm showing here, but this is from an actual live research study. So this is just sort of the model averages for these things. But the idea of looking at these different species of ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, and true fir, and then everything from small diameter snags at the top, you know, stuff that's like this, down to very large at the bottom, and just the idea of sort of how long do they stay in each of these states. And so the really light stuff is more or less that intact dead tree with at least some of the branches still on. The medium gray there is basically top broken off, most of the branches gone, but it's still standing. And then that the black is basically it's probably broken off a couple times and it's still standing, but what's standing is you could kick it and dent it, and it's pretty what we call soft snag. And those are the ones that are getting used a lot for cavities by a lot of different kind of critters. And so the idea here is just saying that basically those really small diameter things are basically going to fall on the ground, become logs and fuel before very long. They're not going to last very long, although it varies, especially ponderosa pines. They're just going to pretty much fall over within the first, say, 10 years. And then when you get down to these bigger ones and things like Douglas fir, not only are they not falling over very fast, I mean, they're breaking off, that's why they get to this stage, but they're standing for a long time, and eventually they actually, you can generate a lot of soft snags, but it's taking you 30, 40, 50 years to make that happen, so it's a very long process. And if fire comes along, the fires will usually drop these. The fire itself will usually burn them enough to tip them over. As for your high elevation ones, If I had studied those, and people have, it's a much longer thing. The decomposition process, because of the cold temperatures, I think they dry up. I mean, they tend to dry out before they can decompose enough. And so those, probably from maybe 4,500, 5,000 feet around here on up, and particularly those subalpine species can really stand for a long time. Depends a little bit on the local moisture conditions and stuff, but they can last for a very long time. We call them silver snags. And even, I suppose if you went up, you used to be able to go up on the tailings, and you know, certainly if you looked up on Martin Ridge, you're gonna see a lot of old whitebark pine snags and stuff, and maybe a few larches and stuff that are gonna last for a really long time. But those are tend to have really dense wood and cold enough that it's pretty slow decomposition.
Dave?
Yeah.
Trivia question. The big logs next in the rock bank next to Hart Lake, they've been decomposing ever since I started coming here ages ago. And I've always wondered when that happened and what they were. Do you know?
Where are they at Hart Lake?
They're on the big, to the right as you come down into the basin. And kind of across the trail. But they're massive. They're like so, and they twist and they have a real spiral to them.
Oh.
At least they used to.
Been a while. I don't know. There were, I mean, you can tell me this is not it. I mean, one thing that's gone on there for a long time is the cottonwoods, if I remember right from our camping experience when I was 14. there were a lot of cottonwoods growing there around, especially where the campground was.
These have been dead for...
And beavers would come along and drop them.
Oh, yeah. These are big, massive things on the slope above the lake that obviously that's not a piece of trivia you were ever interested in. And that's okay.
Well, but again, it's 4,000 feet. It's a cool spot, you know, to get enough snow to stay cold for a long time. And if it's that big around, 50 to 75 years is not an unreasonable time for decomposition. You know, if you're in a warmer, wetter spot, it wouldn't last that long. But even on the west side, in the maritime forests over around Corvallis and stuff, where they've studied a lot of wood decomposition, when you have those really large trees, they last a really long time. And they call them, that's why they have the term biological legacies, because they hang around for maybe up to 100 years. They're decomposing the whole time, and their function changes over time, but they're still recognizable for a very long time. This is the last thing just to point out, that as those snags break and fall, we do generate new fuels. And since this was a fire-related talk, I thought I should bring it back to fuels, which is, and it's always one of the things. So that was the point of this one study I did, was to basically show how that snag decomposition kind of relates to fuel accumulation on the ground, and that there really is this, a lot of people have been arguing that like snags just decompose in place, and as long as they stand long enough, there'll be nothing left to fall. And there's some truth to that. I mean, there is some respiration goes on through bacteria and stuff, but ultimately, most of that stuff, at least half that stuff is gonna at some point break off and fall onto the ground, and then it has to decompose there. And so ultimately, a lot of that tree mass becomes fuel. And so then, that's where you have how long is the fire return interval? If it's going to take 40 or 50 years for that stuff that once it hits the ground to become incorporated into the soil layer, so like how long is it going to be before the next fire? If it's 100 years, that's probably no big deal at all, right? That's great. Lots of fertility, soil water holding capacity, all mulch, all the things that gardeners love. If the fire comes back after 20 years when it's all nice and rotten and very available to burn, then we tend to have those longer residence times, and what we talked about, that the long residence time is what really determines how severe these fires are and how much damage they do to the plant life. And then the one thing answer I can't really come up with is what's the long, I mean, eventually we're expecting this, a lot of this stuff to come back as for, oh, thank you. Oh, well, whatever. Fine, be that way. Eventually, we are expecting a lot of this to come back into forest, but as you saw from that one John Marshall slide, you know, it was 20 years before we got stuff this tall, and my Mitchell Creek said it was, 15 years, and we're just getting stuff this tall. So you kind of have to expect even though some of these sites are going to be a little more productive than that, you know, we're looking at a, you know, a, probably a, even if you can come back in 40 or 50 years, and it's still going to look like young forest, assuming that the trees get established at all. And you know, and the Forest Service is going to be paying a lot of attention to whether there's enough seed source out there and whether seedlings are getting established. And you know, our philosophies have changed over the years, so nobody's trying to make it a deep, dark, dense forest. I mean, we realize that's not sustainable in a fire environment. So nobody's looking at saying, oh, you know, we've got to, you know, plant things on 10-foot spacings and make sure that they self-prune up to a nice tall, you know. But the idea is probably don't need huge shrub fields forever and ever either. We need some shrub fields, but we want to get a mixture. So they'll be watching that. And then, again, there's that sustainability piece in terms of, you know, is what's getting established there likely to be able to survive future fires? Is it going to be able to take the drought conditions that we're expecting to see in the next 20, 30 years? So it's just because something gets established initially doesn't mean it'll persist. And that's something that probably the next research project will be looking at, but we at least have a start on some data to be able to follow that. So that's all I have. Travis?
How would the district decide whether or not they're going to plant seedlings going forward? And would they do that? Is that a thing that is standard after a fire like this?
Well, the Chelan district has had a lot of fire, and I'm not deeply embedded in their meetings, but I've talked to a number of the regeneration foresters, and essentially their general practice is to wait to year 4 or 5 and go out and see what kind of natural regeneration there's going on. I mean, they're already interested. Paul Weir and Kari the ranger have already been asking me. You know, Paul's kind of the guy who would do the planting or would order the planting. You know, I mean, that's why Shannon and Lucy and my team have been counting seedlings on the plots to see, are we getting any? I think Paul's had a couple people doing some informal surveys looking to see generally, are we getting any seedlings? My guess is in another couple of years, they'll do a somewhat more rigorous, they'll either go back and resurvey our plots and or put in some new surveys of their own to see, because they have some sort of a legal requirement to look at regeneration, assure that there's adequate regeneration after 5 years. And if not, that would maybe trigger a decision to. So again, they probably want to look and see how much is out there, what's out there, and is that in line with our management expectations for, you know, a sustainable future kind of thing.
Is that mostly rooted in like timber availability or like logging potential, or is it rooted in like ecological productivity?
Yeah, nobody's really. It's been a long time since, I mean, nobody's really looking at any of this stuff in terms of logging potential. And especially in this valley where there, you know, most of the valley is either, we joked about that's late successional reserve down there where it burned up, but, you know, between wilderness protections and late successional reserves and stuff, I mean, there's not that much of the valley where you could do production logging even, or, you know, any kind of production forestry even if you wanted to. And everybody realizes this valley is all about wilderness and recreation and visitor education and stuff. So it wouldn't be about that, but it would be about protecting natural resources and food webs and developing habitats and those kinds of things so that, you know, so that in the there is a future that meets that sort of multiple use thing. And so we're working back towards some sort of a viable habitat for wildlife, that we're protecting the water and the soil and all that. So that would be the main focus.
I'm curious, you had some slide at the end that talked about becoming fuel.
Yes.
Is that what happened to Domke? I mean, it fell,
yes.
Yeah, but it was only 10 years, not 20.
Yeah, that was the surprising part about Domke is after 7 or 8 years, we didn't really think it would have behaved that way. So admittedly, we were surprised. The best explanation looking back, I think, is probably a combination of, you know, that's the part about breaking off and falling on the ground is
right.
Sort of a random event. And so maybe there was a little more wind that brought more of it down earlier than we thought. But also, it was just really hot and dry. And so those standing snags are apparently just a lot more ignitable than they normally would have been. Because usually you would have expected the fuel on the ground to burn up and a bunch of those snags maybe to fall over because they got chewed away at the base.
Right.
But you wouldn't have expected the actual kind of torching that is obviously happened.
Right.
So that's kind of a new thing. Kari actually said, can you show this? Can you model why that happened? No.
I noticed along the road down here, I went down to Monkey Creek, or came back to Monkey Creek, and noticed several signs on trees that say clear cut.
Yeah.
Is that to try to make a wider area so that the trees don't fall on the road, or what is that all about?
Do you know what I'm talking about? There's like a boundary sign.
Yeah.
Are they on the old ones or the
mine project area? That's when they came before the project to survey where they could and where they couldn't take timber. Actually not related to the, they've been around for some years, but not related to the fire.
Yeah.
That Monkey Bear area has actually been the one area in the valley that I'm aware of that's actually post-mining days that's had some significant actual timber harvest in it. There was back in the 70s or 80s, there was, I think, some selective cutting in there and stuff. Yeah.
So as the climate warms and it's drier and drier, do you anticipate the fires will become both more frequent and more destructive? Or can we predict that?
The thing I think in these middle to high elevation forests, so exclude the dry sagebrush grasslands for a while. If you're talking about these sort of forested areas, I think the first thing you would expect that we would expect to see is that what fire is going to do is mine the excess fuel. And so what you have is, as you go up in elevation, you get to a point where there's more productivity, but because it stays wet longer, there's more moisture, so there's more productivity, so you can, but it doesn't tend to dry out as often or for as long each summer. And so as you go up, you get higher and higher severity fires typically, but they don't happen very often because it's wet. And so if you think about that as there's sort of this fuel surplus that's maintained there because it's wet a lot of the time, if you start heating things up and drying things out, that stuff becomes more and more available. And fires have, and we've seen this in the last 20 years, and particularly in Montana or in the Rockies, but even over here, and there have been some good papers written about that, that basically it's these middle and upper elevation forests that are creating these very large mega fires. And it's because they have all this pre-made fuel on the ground that becomes available because of the drought. And it's really during, it's in years when they burn, in years where we have early low snowpacks and early snow melts, so that those large fuels have a long time to dry out, and then they ignite in the summer and they can burn like crazy because there's just a lot of heat released. And so, and once we get rid of that, it would potentially go back to more like a low elevation forest. But as long as you've got that surplus of fuel and you're generating fuel by killing trees at the same time, you know, you might be talking 3, 4, 5 fire cycles before you really get out of that loop.
Yeah. Are there any areas near here where you see, or any of this pine and spruce up yet that we can see up?
In this valley?
Yes. Right around the camp area here.
Planted?
Just the ones that were planted on the tailings. You guys, how tall are the ones that you're finding? Like, about that tall? Yeah. Okay. So maybe up to 10 inches tall are the tallest ones they're finding running around. Then that's probably, I'm assuming that's down probably near the lower parts of the valley, more likely.
If you walk out on 10 Mile or Monkey Bear Falls Trail, you can see a lot of seedlings, especially where all those lodgepole were.
Yeah.
Out to Monkey Bear Falls.
Well, that's true.
Little guys right along the trail.
Yeah, little guys. But I mean, if they're that big, they're either ones that were there and missed the fire, or they're maybe, I mean, Lodge Pole could potentially do that, I guess.
Monkey Ridge.
But they're going to be pretty short for a while.
It's yeah. A trail just
I don't know if you want to go back to animals, but how long does it take for animals to then recolonize an area? And how does that happen?
Yeah, not my department. Yes, you just walked out. You know, in many years, I think everybody, each to their own. I tell sort of funny story that back when in Deer Point days and Pot Peak, so early 2000s, when they were doing a lot of broadcast seeding of wheat in order to get soil cover, that I would find wheat plants growing out of little clusters of about 50 plants all like this, so you could tell that the rodents were going around and the small mammals were going around and picking it all up and caching it in holes. one of the Chelan wildlife biologists told me once that it was the second year after the Pot Peak fire was the first time in several years that the spotted owl pair there at 25 Mile Creek actually successfully bred young.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And the
food.
Nobody could prove it, but the implication was that all the wheat that was in the straw that was dumped down on the ground in order to hold the soil in place probably managed to feed all those small critters that the owls would prey on. Mm. And so you actually artificially generated a prey base that the owls ate well enough that they are actually able to have a successful brood. But I'm really not the wildlife biologist, so I'll repeat what I hear from others, but I'm not the source of great information on that. Mm-hmm. Shannon?
Returning to the idea of like certain areas that have been planted with trees, uh-huh. Are there any sites that have been designated, we will not plant trees here, and we'll just see how the ecosystem adapts over time to see, rather than trying to restore it back to what it originally was before a disturbance?
Yeah, the question is, are there areas where we wouldn't be dealing with that? Not entirely sure, but my assumption would be that the designated wilderness areas will not be planted under any circumstances. Based on one conversation, I'm not sure that the late successional reserve areas will be planted. I'm hopeful they will. There's a little more wiggle room there. But wilderness areas are supposed to be designated where natural forces can basically operate unimpeded by humans, right? At least that's the theory. So, the parts on the far side of the valley, besides, they're really hard to get to anyway. But I would assume that they're going to be left to regenerate. And the areas where I could see something perhaps happening would be more likely to be maybe the switchbacks area or the Dan's camp area or some of those areas where much closer to roads, much closer to where Holden operates and stuff, and where there might be a perceived need to or a desire to have that turn into forest a little faster than elsewhere. Or again, the problem, the other thing is, we're living with a historical legacy that a lot of big trees were harvested over the last 100 years. And so a lot of the big pines that would have been there are gone. And what you're left with is a lot of those sort of avoider species that are very good seeders, and they're going to be able to seed in. So I'm not really too worried about the density of seedlings, but the question is going to be, are you going to get enough things that can deal well with fire, in order to maintain a sort of a safe. And I don't know. They may very well just leave it alone and let it come back, on the theory that would be consistent with Holden's ethic and that they can't afford to do anything else or whatever. They might very well do nothing anywhere. But if I were to do management, that's where I would think they would do it. Would be down that lower half, along the road. Thank you so much for coming this week. I appreciate all the really good questions. I'll be around till Sunday noon, so if anybody thinks of anything, Sunday morning anyway, coffee break. So feel free to track me down if you want to.